Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's one of those strange things about the news business. Sometimes there's a lot of significance in what didn't happen today. As in, the stock market didn't tank. It was just 2 months ago that Wall Street followed the Shanghai stock market over the cliff. And what was the reaction today when the Shanghai market plunged again? Traders pushed the Dow Industrials to an all-time high. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the important new book, Speaking of Faith, by public radio host Krista Tippett, in bookstores everywhere now. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon, in for Kai Rizdal. It takes an expert to sort through what happened with Chinese stock prices today and why investors here apparently are over the big fears they had when the Shanghai Composite Index plunged nearly 9% in late February. Asian markets were certainly spooked today when Beijing reported China's economy expanded about 11% in the year's first quarter and that inflation is the highest in 2 years. The Shanghai Index dropped 4.5% today. But unlike the last time, Wall Street didn't panic. Joining us to talk about it all is Eurasia Group Director Jason Kindop. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
How significant is what happened today in relative terms?
I think relatively speaking, today's sell-off is entirely warranted. It's interesting that markets will pay attention only during the sell-offs, but I don't think it was very significant considering that China's market has risen almost 150% in the last year and a half. And since the 9% sell-off 6 weeks ago, the market has then resumed its upward trend and gone up 20%. So these are pretty small sell-offs punctuating a continued upward rise in China's markets that many believe is rising too fast, which is the real cause for concern.
And perhaps more level heads prevailed looking at that on Wall Street.
That's right. I think everyone agrees that China's stock market is probably overdue for a correction. At least, you know, some sort of pullback or consolidation after its dramatic rise over the last year and a half.
What kind of action from the Chinese would it take to really set the markets off again?
I think if Beijing came out with some very, very stern tightening measures, and by that I don't mean another 27 basis points interest rate hike, which has been quite commonplace now, but something that really showed they were serious about slowing growth. New curbs on lending and commercial banks, a new campaign to slow investment growth, some very strong language from the top leadership. Those kinds of signals would be concerning to markets around the world.
And how likely is it that we might see that?
Not very, although there is mounting concern in Beijing about China's own stock market bubble. And we are expecting them to take some measures to try to cool market sentiment in China, although it's very delicate because the markets are so high right now and they have such poor tools to deal with it. that they're going to have to tread very carefully to avoid triggering a major sell-off.
Let me bring you back to the Shanghai Index briefly. What are the chances that the Shanghai Index is going to become Asia's premier marketplace with all the volatility that we're seeing?
I think that's a long way off. In many respects, the Shanghai market's playing catch-up after languishing for the first 4 years or so of the emerging market bull run. It's only been within the last year and a half or so that Shanghai's market has begun to rise as well. And with so much liquidity in China's financial system, there are concerns about a bubble emerging. But the premier market prospects rely more on the quality of the firms listed, the transparency of the markets themselves, well-developed regulations, regulatory institutions. All of those are decades away in China's case.
And yet we have this paradox of nobody really taking them seriously, but everybody taking them seriously.
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, China's been such a major driver of global growth over the last couple of years, with its economy growing at around 10%, that any signs that China's economy is wavering will send ripple effects throughout the global markets.
Jason Kindop of Eurasia Group, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So while the markets were moving in China, the world's richest man was throwing open his windows in Beijing. That's where Bill Gates announced that Microsoft wants to practically give away its lifeblood operating system at deep discounts for developing nations that provide computers to kids. Discount prices as low as $3. The Microsoft chairman wasn't wearing his foundation hat when he spoke today. As Marketplace's Lisa Napoli reports, this is all about business.
Bill Gates says that by selling his software cheap, he's hoping to allow people in the developing world to learn technology skills so they can ultimately innovate and create jobs. Peter Brown of the Free Software Foundation says there's more to it.
In fact, this very much reminds me of the Nestle giving baby powder to newborn mothers in the developing world. It appears to be generous at first, but in the long term, does more damage than good.
Brown says better to give people new to technology software they can alter for their own needs, the whole teach a man to fish concept.
Do you want to turn people in developing countries into consumers, or do you want to give them the tools with which they can, in fact, develop their own economies?
Denise Cooper is with the Open Source Initiative, a group that advocates free software. She calls today's announcement an acknowledgement that Microsoft realizes its pricing policies don't work.
If you spend time in the developing world, you realize that all software is free right now because of software piracy.
And because the asking price for legal copies in some countries is often twice the typical annual income. Now the World Trade Organization is cracking down on piracy, and Cooper says Microsoft has to do something to get its product into countries like China and India. Microsoft already has 1 billion customers worldwide, and like so many other businesses, it sees that the future is in the East. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
Google isn't having any trouble commanding top dollar. The internet search and ad giant reports its net quarterly profit rose 69%. That was ahead of Wall Street's expectations. Its net income rose to an even $1 billion in the first 3 months of the year. The news sent Google stock up 2.8% in after-hours trading. The dollars in your wallet lost even more of their buying power overseas today. Currency traders are betting that U.S. interest rates could start falling soon, and that would make the greenback less appealing to foreign investors. The dollar has dipped against the yen, the euro, and the Swiss franc. But its most stunning fall in recent days has been against the British pound. The exchange rate has now topped $2 for every pound. That's a 26-year high for the British note. Good for Britain? Not necessarily, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard explains from London.
The British pound is riding high and humbling the once almighty dollar, but the Brits shouldn't kid themselves, as fund manager Justin Urquhart-Stewart.
Britain will be deluding itself if it feels that sterling is reflecting its strength as an economy.
Sterling has soared, he says, because inflation is rising. It's just hit 3.1%, and that, says economist Andrew Hilton, could spur action from the central bank.
The general feeling is that the British economy is overheating, and that because it's overheating, the Bank of England is going to raise UK interest rates.
Britain's bottom line could get a caning, and says Andrew Hilton, British exporters could suffer double punishment with the stronger pound.
British exporters are going to have a very tough time. British goods are going to be expensive in foreign markets.
Over the summer, thousands of Brits are expected to descend on New York, swaggering around with their pounds, snapping up iPods on the cheap. But the spending spree may soon fizzle. The pound and the Brits may not be riding high for long. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
As we mentioned, another record day for the Dow. The details when we do the numbers. Directors of the World Bank met in Washington today to consider the future of Paul Wolfowitz. The head of the international lending institution is facing growing pressure to resign after acknowledging he arranged a pay raise for his girlfriend, a World Bank employee. Today, the Bush administration repeated its support for Wolfowitz. Commentator Krishna Guha says there's a crisis at the bank that's even bigger than Paul Wolfowitz.
As an institution, the World Bank can't do a thing about Paul Wolfowitz. You see, in theory, the bank's board of directors, representing all the shareholder governments, appoints the president. But everyone knows that in practice, the U.S. president gets to pick who runs a bank, and that person is always an American citizen. The board can't fire Mr. Wolfowitz because the board didn't hire Mr. Wolfowitz. President Bush did. If we're going to fix the firing problem, we have to deal with the hiring process. The time has come for the U.S. to give up its monopoly over deciding who should be bank chief. The World Bank president should be appointed on merit and without regard to nationality. There would be no threat to U.S. interests, because the U.S. would still have an effective veto on bank policies through its board director and its large share of the voting rights. It doesn't need to own the bank president as well. Appointment on merit would allow the bank to hire an outstanding developing country leader as its chief, someone like Trevor Manuel of South Africa or Fernando Cardoso of Brazil. These people have actually dealt with all the tough development issues it talks about. Who do you think would have more credibility talking to leaders in Africa or South America? Mr. Manuel? Mr. Cardoso? Or Mr. Wolfowitz, a former U.S. defense official? If the World Bank's board as a whole hired the bank president, and did so on merit, it would be far more invested in that person's success. The president would have real legitimacy, and he would know he could call on support if circumstances got tough. He would also know that if he ever did something wrong that seriously damaged the credibility of the bank, the board would be able to fire him.
Krishna Guha is chief U.S. economics correspondent for the Financial Times. Your thoughts? Click on the contact link at marketplace.org. In Venezuela, the policies of Hugo Chavez have moved the country towards what he calls 21st century socialism. The left-leaning president has already nationalized the telecom, electricity, and oil industries. Now his government is going to provide workers with 4 hours of free classes each week. Training in Marxism. From the America's Desk at WLRN Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports.
Venezuela's labor minister, José Ramón Rivero, says the classes will start next week for some government workers, and they'll be obligatory. Rivero says laws forcing private companies to offer similar instruction will follow shortly. President Chávez has accelerated his socialist revolution since being reelected in December. Still, his latest measure left observers speechless.
That's astonishing.
Larry Burns is with the left-leaning Council on Hemispheric Affairs.
Certainly, it's not going to be effective. It's going to generate more laughter than respect. And I think it's a counterproductive move.
More counterproductive than you might initially think, says Venezuela-based journalist Phil Gunson.
If the standard working week is 40 hours, and 4 hours are to be taken out of that for socialist education, that's a 10% reduction in productivity.
But Chavez calls his socialist education one of the five engines of his revolution. Mark Weisbrot's with the Center for Economic Policy Research.
These
kinds of measures may sound radical, but the situation in the economy is still very much one of gradual reform.
Gradual in part because Chavez's socialist vision conflicts with the reality of Venezuela's consumerist society. Classes in Marxism could take years to change that. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
The world's biggest restaurant chain is set to report quarterly earnings tomorrow. McDonald's has been enjoying strong sales, with much of its growth lately overseas. Business is booming, even in that land of gastronomic excellence, France. Now, the French still love their truffles and fine wines, but they're increasingly becoming connoisseurs of variations on the Big Mac, along with some fries, of course, which they don't really call French fries over there. As Eleanor Beardsley reports from Paris, McDonald's is succeeding by catering to the marketplace.
On the Champs-Élysées, the restaurant the French love to hate, known here as McDo, is packed with a noontime crowd. France is one of McDonald's top earners, serving 1.5 million customers a year in just over 1,000 restaurants. Eric Gravier is vice president of McDonald's France. He says the chain owes its success partly to adapting to French sensibilities and tastes, like offering burgers with hot regional cheeses in the winter.
All those kind of cheese which are coming mostly from the Alps and from the mountains. You know, like a fondue, tartiflette, raclette. We are not trying to copy. We are just treating it the hamburger way, and the American way, but it's a way to say we are local as well.
McDonald's France has recently come up with another way to go native. It's called the McCafé, and McDonald's plans to open 250 of them across the country in the next 2 years. Customers will be able to engage in a typically French pastime, sitting for hours over a dark coffee and a croissant, but at a lower price.
Latte macchiato, s'il vous plaît.
At a pilot McCafé being tested here on the Champs-Élysées, I order a latte macchiato, the equivalent of my usual café au lait. At tables outside on the sidewalk, McDonald's and McCafé patrons alike soak up the springtime sun and a stunning view of the Arc de Triomphe. German tourist Gudrun Frank says she and her friends wouldn't normally be found at a McDonald's.
It's just because we are walking here and we're looking for a chance to have coffee, and that's a great surprise. I think that we'll enjoy that, yes. Yes, I think it's a good idea, that McCafé, yeah.
McDonald's admits the French cafe culture won't be an easy one to crack, but it hopes to attract coffee drinkers like Gudrun Frank, even luring them away from that other American parvenu, Starbucks.
It's good. I can recommend it to your listeners in the States over there.
In Paris, I'm Eleanor Beardsley for Marketplace.
Coming up, why would a state government help pay for a mall?
Well, the bottom line is it's good for everybody. It generates a bunch of revenue for the state. It adds jobs. Currently, Mall of America provides between 11 and 13,000 jobs. That will jump to about 20,000.
But first, let's do the numbers. A house divided against itself must be on Wall Street. Markets were split again today as strong corporate earnings news mixed with worries about a bad trading day in China. The Dow Jones Industrial Average hammered up 4 points, basically flat, but that was enough to finish the day at a record high of 12,808. The tech-heavy NASDAQ toppled 5 points, 0.2% to close at 2505. The S&P 500 shuttered down 0.1% to end at 1470. Silence isn't always golden, not on Wall Street. BlackBerry maker Research in Motion lost 1.4% in trading today. The reason? RIM won't say what caused its network to crash earlier this week. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers to bring about ideas for nourishing the world. Want to hear something on Marketplace again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and additional special features, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just head over to marketplace.org.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Statebook for events coming up Friday. In Washington, a House committee holds a hearing on FEMA's emergency food supply system. President Bush speaks on the war on terrorism from East Grand Rapids High School in Michigan. And congressional briefings with Blue Planet Run take place on Capitol Hill, giving a whole new meaning to distance running. Blue Planet Run is an around-the-world relay to raise funds for safe drinking water across the globe. Run starts June 1st. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. Time now for the business of sports. Just last night, the National Hockey League's New York Rangers clinched their first berth in the semifinals in 10 years. Great news for New York hockey fans. Maybe better news for the NHL. The sport's been in a long, slow decline. Live attendance remains strong, but TV ratings are a fraction of what they were back when the great one, Wayne Gretzky, was on the ice. Our sports business analyst, Ed Dursey, is here to explain why the ice is no longer so cool. Thanks for joining us, Ed.
My pleasure, Bob.
So I confess I have been to one hockey game in my life a few years ago, a Mighty Ducks game. They've even changed the name of the team or shortened it since I went. It was pretty exciting, but it completely left my consciousness since then. Does anybody really care about hockey now?
Well, it depends on how you define does anyone really care. In terms of attendance, yeah, people care. About 17,000 people a game showed up. Slightly record attendance this year, but mostly flat. But it has a very loyal, hardcore audience. In terms of television ratings, it's much more problematic. Their national ratings are flat. They did about 1.1 million households on NBC and 160,000 households on Versus, the old OLN. It's the regional ratings that are down, and that's a real problem because most people watch most games on their regional sports networks. You know, even poker is outdrawing NHL playoff games these days. And in the long-term perspective, ratings are down more than 50% against 10 years ago.
Out of sight, out of mind. How much was being out of sight in 2005 when they just about wiped out the whole season with those labor troubles? How much did that affect things, and does it still affect things?
Well, the 2005 lockout, which lasted 310 days, almost a full year, was certainly devastating. The American population doesn't really have a lot of tolerance for sports going away. You have to earn that back after that happens. And in a modern media environment where having just hardcore fans isn't enough, it's hard to get those casual fans back. But hockey has other kinds of problems as well. I mean, there's a lack of identity with the players. Most of the players in the league are foreign. It's harder for people to identify with them because they don't have a long history with them. We all know Peyton Manning, but we knew Peyton Manning not just when he was the Colts quarterback, but when he was the quarterback at the University of Tennessee. You know, most people haven't played hockey, so it's hard. You know, we've gone out and thrown the football, shot a basketball, pitched a baseball around the backyard, but how many kids actually have an opportunity to strap on a pair of skates and play a game of hockey, you know, with their friends in the afternoons? And then the last problem is it's not really a great sport on television. Players are covered up. The puck moves very fast. Half the time you can't see it when it goes in the goal, but it's a much better sport live.
Well, I do know that it is exciting live. So what are the upsides? How do they build on those strengths?
Well, the playoffs are great. The great thing about the NHL is when the playoffs come, players play hard from the opening whistle to the end buzzer. Unlike the NBA, where maybe the teams don't play so hard until the fourth quarter, they play in these shifts, a low-scoring game, they play very, very hard. Then you have the Sidney Crosby effect, who's the young star of the league, who the NHL hopes will be the next Wayne Gretzky. And if he is the next Wayne Gretzky, it's going to really help the league. And then they need to change the nature of the game itself. It's a little bit too stop-start. If they make it more fluid, I think it will be better. Rather than being soccer on ice these days, it more resembles frozen water polo.
Our sports business analyst, Ed Dursey, is vice president of interactive media at Fox Sports International. His views on Marketplace are all his own, right, Ed?
Yes, they are.
Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Here's a question you don't hear every day. How about giving public subsidies to shopping malls? And not just any mall, we're talking the country's biggest by number of stores, the Mall of America. It's already a retail and entertainment powerhouse just outside Minneapolis. Now it's asking the state's legislature to help fund an expansion. As Minnesota Public Radio's Annie Baxter reports, the argument is the plan would benefit everyone by boosting tax revenues and creating more jobs.
It's a typical day at the Mall of America. The place is dense with teens wearing shiny lip gloss. Families are scampering through the amusement park at the center of the facility. And as kids whiz around on roller coasters, their screams echo throughout the space. They might look like they're having fun, but the mall's PR director, Dan Jasper, says these people want something more.
As hard as it is to believe, there's not quite enough to do at Mall of America.
To keep visitors adequately amused, the mall wants to add more stores, a skating rink, hotel, and auditorium. The expansion project would more than double the Mall of America's current size, adding more than 5.5 million square feet. That's almost 100 football fields. The price tag for the expansion is $1.8 billion, and the mall wants some of that to come from public sources. Mall officials are seeking sales tax exemptions from the city of Bloomington, where the mall is located. And the mall would very much like the state of Minnesota to chip in with about $180 million for a parking structure. Dan Jasper says the state would get a lot in return.
Well, the bottom line is it's good for everybody. It generates a bunch of revenue for the state, the region, the city. It adds jobs. Currently, Mall of America provides between 11 and 13,000 jobs. That will jump to about 20,000 with phase two.
And, Jasper says, the new and improved Mall of America would draw scores more outstate and international visitors who drop several hundred dollars into the local economy through car rentals, restaurant visits, and the like. But some key legislators in Minnesota aren't buying the pitch.
I don't think mayors and city councils should be willing to tax their people and give huge subsidies to corporations, and I don't think the state should be willing to use state resources.
That's Ann Lincheski, a Democrat from the Minnesota House. She represents the mall's district and is a vocal opponent of the expansion. Lincheski heads the House Tax Committee, which recently said it would consider a mall bill for possible inclusion in some bigger tax legislation. In the meantime, Lincheski is hoping her committee members will decide that mall subsidies are imprudent. At a recent hearing, she trotted out the director of research at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, Art Rolnick, to help drive home the point that the Mall of America does not need the state's help.
If they wouldn't do this expansion on their own, my guess is the markets, that's a market signal. Let the market figure out how big they should be.
But some Minnesota legislators say it's possible to fund the Mall of America expansion without tapping state coffers. A bill in the state Senate would have visitors pay higher sales tax at the mall. Mall visitor and area resident Kelly Laurie says she'd be okay pitching in with user fees or anything else to help the mall expand. She says the mall's been a great thing for the state.
Mall of America's been a great thing for Minnesota as far as being kind of putting us on the map, getting people here.
Some people think of it as like our Eiffel Tower.
Right, right. Sadly enough.
Mall of America officials say they won't be able to undertake the expansion without adequate public support. But it's unclear they'll get what they want this legislative session. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, understanding the advantage of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, we can finally breathe easier, literally. We may finally be out of this year's flu season now the weather's warming up. But there's no rest for the weary. Drug manufacturers, that is. Flu vaccine makers are already getting ready for next winter. They expect to manufacture a record 132 million doses, more if an Australian company, CSL Biotherapies, gets U.S. approval. Health officials recommend more than 200 million Americans get flu shots each year. We aren't all doing that. Out of 121 million doses made this year, officials say they may have to destroy millions. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 4 points, basically flat, but did close at another record high of 12,808. The NASDAQ lost 5 points, 0.2%. The S&P 500 fell 1.1%. Our editors include John Buckley, Margaret Koval, Karen Lowe, Stacey Vanek-Smith, and Lisa Tucker. Next time, if you really want to be a green gardener, you've got to find an alternative to those plastic pots.
The pots are made out of rice hulls. It is a byproduct. They're actually manufactured in China.
I'm Bob Moon. Please join us again tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.